Today's show is dedicated to the memory of Katie Snyder Evans, a longtime member of the online Mormon community who was killed by a drunk driver while returning home from visiting her newborn twins at the NICU. A support fund for the family has been established, and we will include a link in the show notes. All Patreon donations to the Mormon News Report podcast for the month of October will be donated to this fund. Katie leaves behind her husband, Jacob Evans, her children, Spencer, who is 12, Travis, 11, Nathaniel, 9, Gideon, 2, and her preemie twin girls, Hannah and Sarah, who are not even 8 weeks old yet. Our heartfelt thoughts are with the Evans family during this incredibly difficult time.
The Mormon News Report podcast for the week of October 30th, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With a healthy dose of snark and, Brian, we are the foremost hipsters in shilling for Patreon subscribers. You know, before it was cool.
Yeah, it seems like everybody's doing that now, Brant. I see podcasts, Mormon-themed podcasts, springing up everywhere asking for your support on Patreon, which is cool. I mean, that's great. But just remember, you heard it from us first.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, we have a fantastic show lined up for you today. Historian Brittany Chapman Nash is going to be here to talk about her latest book, which is co-edited with Richard Turley, titled Women of Faith in the Latter Days, Volume 4, 1871 to 1900, published by Deseret Book.
Brian, this is a really fun time in Mormon history. I know you and I both have been waiting for the church historians to get to this period in Mormon history. And frankly, I'm really giddy because there's some great stories in there, and we'll talk about a lot more with Brittany. But before we get all hot and heavy into the news, we do have a few housekeeping items to get to. For example, we have an iTunes review. We do. Cragman 8 writes, great effort to tell truthful LDS news. I love this news report. They do their homework and find everything reported about the LDS church. They don't give it either PR or anti-spin. They really try to honestly tell it like it is with a bit of snark, which is always entertaining. Keep it up. Well, hey, Cragman, thank you. We appreciate it.
And we also had a question of the week from last week, something new that we're going to be starting and hopefully throwing out each week. And we got some responses, didn't we?
We did. So the question last week, do you think the new missionary interview questions will be a positive or negative and why? Remember, we had gone through, they were mostly the temple recommend questions with a few other ones tossed in there. There was some tell me your testimony of blank and some questions about mental health. Here's one from DJ. I think it has great potential to be used to help missionaries be assigned to missions that they can handle so that missionaries that have mental or emotional issues don't find themselves way in over their head and end up miserable or having to come home early and all the stigma that comes with that. On the other hand, there will certainly be church leaders who will use this information to unfairly exclude young men and women from service when they could otherwise have an effective and rewarding experience. And Brian, I think that kind of leads to what we think about it, which is there's some good, but there's some concern there. And it's very much a rational middle road take, which is, okay, let's see what happens with this, right?
Yeah, it's the on the other hand approach, which I think we say quite often on this show.
Mm-hmm. Here's another one from an anonymous emailer. One really obvious thing that I think was missed in your podcast about the questions for missionaries is that the list does not include a question about masturbation, perhaps the ultimate taboo subject within LDS culture. One reason for the standardization of temple recommend questions many years ago was because there were church leaders interrogating people about things like birth control, bedroom sexual practices, only one acceptable way to do it, and you had better be wearing your garments when that happens, drinking Coke, whether you watch sports on Sunday, and much more. I suspect that a big reason for this list is to limit the questions and reduce the opportunity for freelancing. Brian, that's a very fair point. I actually know some people out in Utah that had to have a bit of a meeting with their stake president because their stake president was going down the road of saying, what about Diet Coke? Do you drink that? Because I don't think that that's part of the word of wisdom. So maybe the standardization isn't a bad thing. Maybe.
No, I think he makes a fair point in this. He, she, whoever it was that sent this in, that sometimes standardization can keep us out of trouble.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. And everyone, we appreciate the reviews, the comments, and the write-ins. We're going to have another question of the week this week. And so remember, you can contact us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. You could tweet at us on Facebook or on Twitter at The Mormon News, or send us a message on Facebook at our Mormon News Report Facebook page. But Brian,
should I fess up?
I got to call you out, buddy.
Should I fess up, Brant, from my gaffe last week?
You know, okay, so the big question is, do you think anyone caught your gaffe?
Oh, yes. I got personal messages sent to me on Facebook. We had responses to our Facebook post. Yeah, you know, I mean, anybody who knows anything about history is like, whoa, wait a second. So let me explain what the gaffe was. Last week, I was all excited because I had attended the Joseph Smith Papers conference, and part of the conference, they had announced that they will be publishing through the Church Historians Press the William Clayton Diaries. Now, I didn't say William Clayton. For some reason, the word McClellan got lodged into my brain, and it was just like cemented. And throughout the entire first part of the episode, I kept referring to it over and over again as the William McClellan Diaries. So, yeah, a little bit of mud in my face. Sorry about that, guys. It's William Clayton.
I mean, listen, Brian, anyone who knows anything knew that it was obviously William Clayton. I mean,
right?
Come on.
I mean, come on.
So anyways, hey, I the good news is this. We have people that listen to the show that want to call us out on things. And I am totally good with being fact checked to death, unlike some others out there. Anyways, Brian, we had an issue with our website this week, and I think we need to get it out there just so everyone's aware. We're going through some server migration right now. And so if you're trying to find back episodes of the Mormon News Report podcast, as of right now, we are missing the October episode. So we're going to have October 2nd out there, but we're missing everything up until this point. I'm hoping to have that fixed by tomorrow.
I think, Brant, let's be honest. I think they've disappeared into the upside down.
Listen, that is what we call a culturally relevant topic right there.
I'm on episode five, Brant. Don't spoil anything for me. I know that you watched all of it. Right?
No, we are on episode six. As a matter of fact, my wife is not too happy with me because she said, okay, hey, we're going to watch Stranger Things tonight, right? And I was like,
I got a show to do. This podcast
thing. But I guess there's a Mormon reference in season two, so we all got to watch out for the Mormon.
There's a Mormon reference in season two of Stranger Things?
There is a very brief Mormon reference that everyone's...
I thought that just the title Stranger Things alone was a Mormon reference.
I thought the fact that we're talking about 1980s and, you know, anyways. But Brian, there is one place where people can get episodes, right?
There is. Patreon. Trusty Patreon. So yeah, if you want to check out our back episodes while we're switching servers and while we get our new episode, our most recent episodes back up and running, head on over to Patreon for where $1 per month will give you access to not only all of our back episodes, but also all of our extended sessions that we have with guests when we have, you know, a little bit more to talk about while they're coming and visiting with us.
It is my most favorite time of every episode when we get to the extended sessions because, you know, like we joke about, I wear a shirt and tie when I do this show because I want to make sure it's professional. I loosen the tie, roll out the sleeves. We have a little bit of fun with our guests. But Brian, we got news this week, don't we? So should we get into it?
Let's get into it.
It's Halloween week this week, and so everybody out there who has some sort of a Mormon connection is doing the spooky Mormon stories. For example, this one from the Southern Utah Independent. They have a story on Mormons and ghosts, and they profile Marlene Murray, a practicing Mormon and a member of the group Spiro Paranormal Investigations, who look at creepy reports in Pocatello. So this is what the piece says. Marlene is an active Mormon, and Mormons tend to stray away from the believing side of this sort of thing, which is actually kind of strange. Central to our faith is a belief in certain supernatural interactions. Should it be a stretch for us to be believers in the paranormal? Why is Moroni okay, but not other entities? Heck, anyone who has spent much time doing genealogy or talking to family history buffs has certainly heard tales of long-deceased Grandpa Ira or the like making connections to the living. Why, then, are some of us squeamish about other types of ghostly encounters? And Brian, I mean, it's Halloween week. We got to expect that we're going to get stories like this, right?
Right. But getting back to what she said, I think that she makes a fair point. I mean, we've learned growing up that the spirit world or the place that we're all kind of temporarily parked before we move on into the millennium is around us. It's a finer matter. We can't really see it. But it is parked. I think where Mormons have trouble with the idea of ghosts haunting a place is we don't like the idea of people just being stuck here and not having moved on to that spirit world where they're maybe being taught or, you know, progressing to some extent or another, but kind of being held back in that progression. We have a hard time with that part, I think.
Well, and going along with that too, I mean, when you think of ghost stories and things like this happening, it inspires fear in people. And I don't think people want the thoughts of these spirits to be fearful things, which is why it's always the happy stories like they talked about with Grandpa Ira, you know, slowly directing someone towards trying to find his records or whatever, versus maybe something like the Maxwell Institute did this week, which, by the way, shout out. That was a great show that the Maxwell Institute did with Blair Hodges and Steve Taysom on Mormon exorcism lore and kind of some spooky ghost stories. Did you get a chance to listen to it, Brian?
Gotta say, Brant, I did. And it is, right now, it's my favorite Maxwell Institute podcast. They went all out on this one. And not just for the content. I mean, Blair has had some tremendous content in the past with Maxwell Institute. But the production that Blair put into this one, he had readers on there. He had great music. He had sound effects. He had it all there. And he really created a really nice, enjoyable, entertaining, and informative episode. It was wonderful.
So he said that at the end of the episode that he mimicked it after the podcast series Lore, which is really good. If you haven't had a chance to check it out, they talk about different. It's basically what they did with this episode. They take a story, they dive into it, they talk to experts, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what I liked about this one is this was a really compelling story. They were talking about the whole concept of exorcisms, where it started, where we're currently at in the church, where we're going with certain things, discussion about the devil. And it was with everything you said, Brian, with the narrations, with the music, with everything. The production value was great. And I was listening to it really captivated. And as I probably shouldn't say this, but my wife's not going to listen, so I don't have to worry. I was listening to it on the way home from work, and she kept calling me wanting to know if I was on my way home from work yet. And I kept turning, you know, I kept rejecting her call because I want to keep listening. That's how compelling it was. Good news is she's not listening, so I don't need to worry about that.
Well, but Steve Taysom is the right historian to have on for this. He recently published an article on the same topic of exorcism in a pretty renowned journal. And he's been researching this for years. He also teaches a course on the devil at the university that he teaches at. He's perfect guy to have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And additionally, I will say, Brian, I think you're with me on this. We give this the Mormon News Report thumbs up. Everyone should check this out.
Absolutely. Two thumbs up.
So moving on, there is a story out this week from I wouldn't really call it the Southeast. It's the Pacific area in New Zealand. New Zealand has a new prime minister. This prime minister left the LDS church. She is a former Mormon, and she left the church due to the church's views on homosexuality. As a matter of fact, her name is Jacinda Ardern. Jacinda, something like that. I'm hoping I pronounced it right. She said, "For a lot of years, I put it to the back of my mind. I think it was too unsettling. If something like religion is part of your foundation, and then suddenly you start questioning that, it's quite a confronting thing to deal with." And Brian, this is getting passed around a lot on the Mormon internets, mostly because this is one of the highest profile people who have made a conscientious decision to leave the LDS faith due to a subject like homosexuality and the church's views on homosexuality that has probably one of the highest profile, would you say?
Yeah. I mean, so I think it's good for generating conversation, especially how as high profile as she is. But on the other hand, I feel like her story is being a bit abused and passed around by a lot of people as sort of their, you know, as further justification for their own decision to have left the church. So in a way, I kind of feel like she's being used for a different end than perhaps what she should be.
Wait a minute. You mean people on the internet take other people and weaponize them for whatever purposes they want? Brian, I don't believe you at all.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, Brent.
But this goes back to my mantra that I got, Brian, that Mormons are going to Mormon and ex-Mormons are still going to Mormon, because we Mormons, we do the same thing. Anytime that there is someone who has gained any sense of notoriety or high profileness who is a Mormon, we're going to immediately prop them up and say, guys, see, look at this. We're just like you. We're just as prominent as you. Look at this. And now it seems like the disaffected or the ex-Mormons are kind of having the same thing now, where they can prop Jacinda or however you pronounce her name. I'm sorry, I'm completely butchering it. But besides the point of how her name is pronounced, but they can hold her up and go, see, here's someone who's high profile, who's ex-Mormon. So take us seriously, take us legitimately. And I'm kind of sitting here going, Why can't people just be people instead of you using them for whatever purposes you have on whatever things you've got? It just doesn't make sense to me.
You know, but to go along with that, let's talk about the other high profile Mormon in the news this week and how that's also being utilized for both good and ill.
That's right. Jeff Flake, who is a Republican of Arizona, gave a speech on the Senate floor on Tuesday. And I would say, Brian, that he went all general authority on Tuesday, where he gave a stinging rebuke to Republican Party to the Republican Party and to Donald Trump. So this is from Lori Goodstein at the New York Times. She talked with Jeff Flake, and Jeff said, "We are taught that we ought to stand up for what we know is right and also to be decent. I hope I'm acting on the faith that I believe in." She also talked with Steve Evans of By Common Consent on why Mormon political leaders would be among the major headliners of anti-Trumpism. So what she's talking about there is people like Evan McMullen, Jeff Flake, Mitt Romney, and others. So this is what Steve Evans said. "This is born out of a strong sense of personal morality, but also out of a cultural sense of decorum. Mormons are prudes, both privately and publicly, but there's also strong scriptural teaching behind it all. The Book of Mormon warns the reader that America is a choice land and that we must be careful in choosing our leaders, and the judgments of God can come on a people that choose evil leaders. Religious teachings like these may be informing their worldview." And Brian, I will tell you this. I really, really like the fact that Lori is branching out to other prominent Mormons like Steve Evans, because Lori does really good reporting. This isn't her first story on Mormon topics, and every time that she's done one, it's been really, really good. And I think you know exactly what I'm referring to, Brian, but I'm glad that she is branching out to people outside of that. So she talked with Steve. She also talked with Max Perry Mueller. Hey, we know that guy, don't we?
No, we know that guy.
He said it was very much a Mormon speech. He said that speech reflects a Mormon understanding of human agency and participation in history, that humans bring about change and move the world towards perfection.
And if anybody can pick up on the Mormon accent, it's Max Perry Mueller.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the benefit of having an objective outsider, right? Like, he's like, oh, yeah, I know what that is. I know exactly what that is. Brian, did you get a chance to see the speech?
I watched bits and pieces of it, to be honest with you. It happened while I was working, so I was a little bit distracted. What I did catch, though, particularly the part about it was the "what about our children" part. I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but it was the "what are we going to tell our children down the road if we didn't stand up and say anything?" That part really hit me.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I you probably had the same thing that I did, where as soon as he was giving the speech, it started popping across all of my different, you know, whether it was Twitter or Facebook or whatever, all these things, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, something big's happening. So I came home that night and I was reading parts of the speech to Ashley. It was good, but it didn't really have the effect that we wanted. And it's a great speech to read. We ended up watching it on YouTube later that night. And the first words that Ashley said was, "This guy sounds like a general authority, both in just the way he sounds, the way he looks, the way he's reacting at the podium, just all those different things."
He even had the general authority grip on the podium, if I remember.
Like, I'm sitting. So, all right, conspiracy theory time, Brian.
Conspiracy theory
is.
We need a noise for this.
I know. Well, yeah, the noise.
Like X-Files, like an X-Files opening theme noise or something.
Or maybe my furnace kicking on in the background.
Stranger Things.
So here's my conspiracy theory. Jeff Flake is in this speech. He announced that he's not going to run for re-election. All right, I got two conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theory number one: he's going to make a run in 2020.
For president.
Yeah. So if you were to go from 1 to not at all possible to 10 completely possible and completely, yes, it's definitely going to happen. Do you think he's going to run for president? Where would you put that on the conspiracy theory timeline or spectrum?
So I'm sitting at a 4, but so I'm on the low end.
Okay.
But I'll tell you why after you say your next thing.
Okay. Because I would say I think it's about a 6 or a 7, because I really think in 2020 you could see a decent amount of Republicans trying to run against him, including him. I could even see Mitt Romney jumping back in. I think that Jason Chaffetz is gearing up for a run for the Utah governorship. But I could see him making not in 2020, but 2024, 2028. I mean, you got to take the long game with this.
Didn't he just get a Fox News spot or something?
He did, but that's the rumor. So here's the rumors. The rumor is Chaffetz is going after the Utah governorship once Herbert is done. Romney is going to go after the Utah Senate spot when Orrin Hatch retires. And then you've got this with Jeff Flake. Those are three prominent Mormons. Who knows what could happen with that? Okay, so here's conspiracy theory number two.
Wait, let me respond. Let me respond to why I gave him a 4.
Okay, tell me why you gave him a 4.
Because I think he's looking at a VP ticket more than a presidential ticket.
I mean, it'd have to be, would it be a 2020 ticket?
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking it could very well be a Romney and Flake ticket.
You know, listen, if we didn't think things were bad enough back in 2012,
right,
all the Mormon stuff.
Yeah, let's get two Mormons. See what happens.
Let's get two Mormons to run on a ticket. That'll be great. Although, it depends on how the anti-Trump sentiment goes. If there's a lot of anti-Trump sentiment, all of a sudden you're sitting here going, two outsiders who have been consistently against Donald Trump, running against him while Donald Trump is the incumbent president. That could make a very interesting 2020.
Yeah, except it's really tough to call Flake consistently against Trump when you look at his voting record.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
he's been 100% across the board for Trump. So I think he's going to get his nose smeared into that if he does decide to run.
Because that's been the biggest criticism I've heard of him is, look, that was a great speech, but you still got to defend your record that you consistently voted with Donald Trump on all these issues. And now
I like what Stephen Colbert said. He said, you know, he finally grew a pair and then he decided to take his balls and go home.
Stephen Colbert has been such a blessing and a gift during this election period. Okay, so here's conspiracy theory number two. Conspiracy theory number two. Jeff Flake will be a general authority at some point.
We say this about every, like, especially particularly like Republican politicians that are Mormon, yeah. Right? It's always once they're out of the political business, they're going to become a general authority. I haven't seen it happen yet. Every time that we do have a Mormon that's involved in politics, it's usually after they've already had their calling. Like, for instance, Ezra Taft Benson being the Secretary of Agriculture, right? Or people being called on to cabinet positions. I haven't seen it the other way around.
Listen, I'm gonna throw a bone to all you historians out there or anyone who wants to come up with some sort of a paper or whatever. Track Mormon politicians and then what happens to them after they're done in politics. Do they have a general authority type calling? What kind of calling do they have? Where does it go from there? I'd be intrigued to see does it just not happen? Do people just kind of go?
I'd be surprised if they even get onto their local high councils, to be honest with you, because they're still celebrity figures.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so that was the Jeff Flake speech. Brian, there's a lot of other news we got to get into. We got to get into the missionary work one next. Now, we covered some of it last week, but there was other things that came out that we didn't really get a chance to get into because we wanted to talk so much about the questions themselves. So this is from the Deseret News. Church leaders announced plans on October 20th to reduce the number of LDS missions to better fit the needs of each region in the world, to replace the use of tablets, usually it's from what I've seen, it's been iPad minis in missions, with smartphones, and to increase the use of technology to help find people interested in religion. Additionally, church leaders introduced a standard set of interview questions, which we talked about last week. So the two big things that happen out of this, there is a decrease in missions and an increase in the use of technology. Here's what Brent H. Nielsen, a General Authority 70, said. We've leveled off to around 70,000 missionaries. It's still way up from the 58,000 we had. In the orderly process of accommodating changes in our numbers, we'll be slowly closing missions because we don't need as many as we required for the great increase we experienced in 2012 and 2013. So, Brian, you know where we're going with this because you know exactly how the internet's going to react to this.
Oh, man. The church is falling apart at the seams. This is proof. It's proof that it's all falling apart. Nobody's converting to Mormonism anymore. We're closing up the missions and we're packing our bags and going home and we'll see you on Facebook.
You must have been reading the same websites that I was seeing. Okay. Brian, what's the rational take on this? Because that is something to be talked about, right? The fact that we jumped up to 70,000, or I think we hit a high of like 86,000 or something.
Yeah, there's going to be a leveling off at some point. It's a really simple rationale. At some point, there's a leveling off, and then you kind of have to just relook at everything out there, reconfigure everything, and make sure that everything makes sense. Because we put a lot of investment into this, both financially, manpower-wise, and woman power now, right? I mean, there's far more female missionaries out in the field. You just kind of have to be smart about all this kind of stuff. And it reminds me of the overambitious building project that happened in the 1950s. And we were building chapels everywhere. It was kind of the, you know, if you build it, they will come model. And it almost sunk us into the red. I think it did sink us into the red financially. So, you know, at some point you kind of have to say, all right, let's kind of back off a little bit in the pedal here and make this make sense.
So I'm kind of with you, but I think there's two schools of thought that you could use to look at it. So one school of thought is, look, you increase it a lot. Excuse me. You increase it a lot, which is what we did, right? And then you see where that leveling off comes. And let's say if they were at 58,000 before, you level it off to 70,000 now. So what you increase the number, and that's going to be the standard number growing forward. Okay, so that is where the tide settles, and that's where the average is, and that's where we're going to keep going, right? On the other hand, you can kind of sit there and go, why did you increase it all the way up to 86,000 at one point with this huge push for everything that we were doing only to have that tide level off to 70,000? Because there's a part of me that says, Where are we going with this? It's not a secret if you talk to people that the traditional way of doing missions is not the best way. And so I think I would feel differently if we leveled off with 70,000 missionaries and we increased and we're doing different things, but we're really not. We're still doing the same things. Now, I know that they're doing that missionary pilot program. I know that they're still doing service missions, but those are relatively small compared to some of the other things, the traditional missionary work. So I'm kind of sitting here going, okay, not that I want to give the disaffected community any bones, but maybe this is the reality. We're not at 58,000 where we used to be, but we're at 70,000, and they say that number is going to stabilize, but is that number going to fall and go back to the 58? I don't know. On the one hand, I sit there and say it's natural with the number of Mormons that we have and how many people we have on record that number would increase. But on the other hand, it's like, I don't know. I don't want to be a jerk, but do we really need 70,000 missionaries? Do we really need 70,000? Because that's a lot.
Well, and I'll get back to what we discussed last week is if we've varied the missions a little bit and created more service missions, then yeah, we do need that many missionaries out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's another part. The church has long recognized that missionary methods and approaches need to be updated as cultures and technologies shift and change, according to this release that the Deseret News received. After consulting with leaders in the technology world, the number of missions using mobile devices is being increased from 87 to 162. Tablets are being replaced with smartphones, and in the future, most missionaries will arrive on their mission with a smartphone to assist them in their study, finding, and teaching, the release noted. Let's acknowledge what's going to happen from the online community. Wait a minute. Missionaries are going to get iPhones. What the heck? We have people in Mexico or other places where money is not as prominent. They can barely eat, but the missionaries are going to get iPhones. I think that's a little... I don't like that rationale, mostly because smartphones are starting to become more and more standardized throughout the world. There are some, I would even say there are some safety benefits to having smartphones and being always connected in a situation like that.
Yeah, no question.
And Brian, look, for me, I was kind of an idiot. I looked around my triple combination, the big, not the old person, huge reader style. That's probably not nice, but whatever.
That's the kind that I use to read scriptures with my family, Brant. Thanks.
But I looked around mine for my normal size triple combination, my entire mission. And a lot of people were like, well, you just need a Book of Mormon. Why are you taking everything? I don't know. I just took everything with me. My life would have been so much easier if all I had to do was worry about carrying a smartphone with me. I would have had my scriptures. I would have had everything I needed there, and I wouldn't have had to worry about anything. So I don't know. I don't have a problem with the transition from tablets to smartphones. And I'm okay with the church saying, okay, this is what the world and technology require now is having smartphones. And who knows what kind of apps that they're developing.
Did we make the same complaints when they started getting cars, right, in certain areas where cars made sense? Did we start saying, well, they're going into these areas where, there's impoverished people that can't even afford a bicycle, let alone a car. And here's these missionaries cruising around in a Corolla. Those same arguments?
Brian, back in my day, we took a horse everywhere. We walked. We had blisters on our toes. And if you were one of those mamby-pambies, you took a bike. We walked and we liked it.
And we walked and we walked and we walked. Mm-hmm. All right. Hey, let's get to our top story.
This one has been an interesting one. This is a letter that was sent out from the LDS Church to everybody in the world, and it was actually read at my sacrament meeting today on Sunday. In the spirit of reducing and simplifying the work of the church and the demands made upon leaders and members, we are pleased to announce that the Council of the First Presidency and Quorum of the 12 has decided to modify the General Conference meeting schedule. Beginning in April 2018, the General Women's will no longer be held on the Saturday preceding the other sessions of General Conference. Rather, the General Priesthood and General Women's sessions will be held annually, with the General Priesthood session being held in April and the General Women's sessions being held in October. These meetings will originate from the Conference Center on Saturday evening following the morning and afternoon sessions of conference. The session times of General Conference will not change. We are confident this change will be a blessing in the lives of members throughout the world, throughout the church. Sincerely yours, the First Presidency. Okay, Brian, this is not the best worded. This is like, man, this is bureaucracy 101. So here's what's going to happen. The General Women's meeting will be in October on Saturday night. The General Priesthood meeting will be in April on Saturday night. There is not going to be a women's meeting 2 weeks before. This is all going to be part of the same General Conference package. On Saturday, you will have the AM session, the PM session, and then a night session for one of those two groups, whether it's in April or October for the priesthood or the women. Sunday's going to be the same. So they've consolidated the schedule a little bit, but this is the new reality that we live in. Welcome to, I was going to say Welcome to Trump's America, but that's a very different one.
Let's not conflate those two.
No, but this is the new direction that they're taking, and the reaction's been interesting, Brian. I'm not sure what you've seen from your end, but I've seen some people with some interesting perspectives.
You did a little poll and had a respectable. I mean, this poll ran for maybe 2 days, but you had a respectable amount of people respond to your poll.
I did. We need to do the same qualification that we did with the last poll, which is this is not scientific. This is not random. This is not anything. But we had 151 responses. So I think that's enough that we can get into it a little bit. Question one.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can have an honest discussion on that.
Yeah. Question one. Are you pleased, disappointed, or have no opinion about the new consolidated general conference schedule? 70% of the respondents were pleased. 7% were disappointed, and 23% had no opinion. So on the whole, a majority of them either said, this is a good thing, or whatever. There were not that many people that were disappointed with it.
Yeah, and those who were disappointed are kind of the kind of people who think we should have more meetings, not less.
It's probably not them. Probably not. Either that or we'll get into it when we get to, so we actually opened it up for some verbatim responses where people could type what they thought. There might be a reason why people are disappointed, so we'll get into that. Question number two, do you think the new consolidated general conference schedule will have a positive long-term effect, a negative long-term effect, or no long-term effect? 59% of the respondents said that they felt it would be a positive long-term effect, 3% said it would be negative, and 38% said there would be no effect. So it's a lot like the first question. People either thought it's going to be a good thing or, meh, it's no big deal. So if we look at the main buckets of comments that people make, because we had I would say we probably had about 70 people add their comments. From what I saw, they fell into three big areas. Number one, a concern for less women speakers. For example, I didn't think there was a way to make it so even fewer women would speak in conference during a calendar year, but here we are.
It's a legitimate concern.
Oh, it is. And Brian, would it surprise you if someone who was making that kind of comment, especially with the concern for less women speakers, were saying that and not exactly happy that now there are less opportunities to hear women speakers at general conference?
No, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
So here's another one. I suspect this will be used to overall reduce the number of women speakers at conference. And this is my favorite one, a direct quote. This was transcribed by a mom from their 13-year-old daughter. All they did was give them a different time slot. If you think this is a big deal, then you really don't know what feminism is. Hashtag fake feminism.
Ouch. Yeah, that's pretty to the point there.
You don't want to tick off the 13-year-old demographic, okay? They are brutal, and I say that as someone who works with the youth. They will come after you, and they are harsh.
And they've got their hashtags ready.
They do. Listen, we are just old fogies when it comes to this hashtag game, Brian. All right. So here was the other bucket of comments. Fewer meetings equal better. So how about that third block? How about that 3-hour block that we've got on Sunday? Here's a couple of responses. Now, let's work on the schedule. The 3-hour block is counterproductive in so many ways, especially missionary work. Really? You think an investigator wants to jump into that?
Yeah.
They're not wrong. I'm always concerned about that. Here's another one. Fewer meetings equal usually better. If the goal is to strengthen the family, more time with the family and less time in meetings is usually a good answer. Plus, more time to practice Christianity instead of talking about it is always good, which is, yeah, I don't disagree.
I think that's a better point than the previous one.
I do. And finally, Brian, my favorite. This is the third bucket that we had. Why would you even bother asking? The Lord guides the church. It's not your place to question.
Yeah.
These are my favorite.
All right.
Here's one. It shows a powerful example of the importance in simplifying operations in the church. The brethren are well aware of the needs and challenges of the saints, and this is a great step forward to simplify. It will also do something to remind people that the church is living, i.e. still growing up. That's not a bad response. I don't mind that one.
I like the growing up part. I mean, it's, you know, we don't usually put it in those terms. We don't usually say it's still growing up as if we're still in some sort of adolescent stage.
Right. I think it was our friend Christine Haglund who described it in 2012 that basically said, look, Mormonism is going through adolescent growing pains in front of everyone's eyes. A lot of other religions haven't had to do that with the media and all these things. And so, yeah, we are kind of growing up and we're relatively young. And listen, I am not one of those traditionalists that are saying, no, we have to have the general conference needs to be this way. And it's always going to be. I really don't care that much. It's fine. Here's another one. When you go to church every week and participate in a calling, I don't think that one less meeting each year has any effect on your spirituality.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's no, I that's fine. I mean, where do you take that though? Right. Do you take that into a general conference session and say, well, maybe we should just go down to two, just one on Saturday, one on Sunday, because it's not going to have any great effect on your spirituality. I mean, the fact is we're talking about if there's any meetings that get utilized in writing talks, in creating lessons, it's the meetings that come out of these weekends. So I kind of reject the premise that it's just one meeting out of the year, right? So you're talking about ward council, you're talking about, you know, one of these local area meetings that could probably be reduced. I get it. But we're talking about meetings that have a major impact on the church membership.
Yeah. Well, we've got a little bit of time. I can get into a little bit of a brant rant. Listen, I get what everyone's saying about the meetings, okay? Because I do think that we do meeting overkill in the church, and I don't know if that's necessarily a church problem. I've got it at work. One of my favorite coffee mugs that I ever saw anyone ever buy was a coffee mug that said, this is another meeting that could have been an email. Like, there are so many times where we could have situations like that. However, and I'm just saying from my own personal life experience right now in my own personal ward, it's not that I want to do overkill by meetings, but frankly, if you don't have people who understand how to utilize technology, how to collaborate outside of church services and church areas and things like that, sometimes you do have to have a lot of meetings because that's the only way you can get stuff done. That's the only way you can get people in a room. That's the only way you can get a decision, despite the fact that you might be clamoring tooth and nail to get them to that point. So I'm not saying we need to overload everybody with meetings. I'm not. And I know that, you know, someone like Elder David A. Bednar has said, I wish we could eliminate that from our vocabulary. I get where he's going with that because there's so many times where it's like, well, we got this email. We might as well have a meeting about it. Oh, I've got a question. Let's get everyone together for a 1-hour meeting. Let's go through the normal meeting cadence. I'm not saying we need to do something like that. But I'm also saying, look, let's get off the whole meetings are the death of us bandwagon, because if you're in any sort of position where you're trying to get things done within the church, you're going to have meetings. And sometimes just, you know, once a month, once a week, sometimes isn't good enough, depending on how big the thing you're trying to accomplish. So that's, let me get into this, to this other one. I think you're going to love this, Brian. I like the idea that the women's session is incorporated into the main conference. Pause. Okay. I'm with you. I like that idea.
That was really my first comment on this was, I think that we still have trouble viewing the women's session, which has been traditionally held the weekend prior. We still have trouble viewing it as part of the main general conference, despite how many times the brethren have assured us that it is part of the main general conference. So I think that this gives it an air of legitimacy that we've been struggling to have.
Right. And there's no question now. Like, we all know, yep, this is part of general conference and you can't get around that. All right. So let's get back to this question. I dislike the evidence that we are continuing to slide into couldn't be bothered to inconvenience ourselves irrelevance. What? We need a break from watching one more broadcast a year, especially when it was a meeting only women bothered to watch. This relieves the cost and time commitments of the membership. What's next? Finding strangers to attend our meetings by proxy so we never have to go to church?
Well, okay.
I'm not exactly opposed to that. You know what, Brian? Listen, that's going to be our get rich quick scheme in Utah. We will go to church. You know what? No, we'll have to do it on like BYU campus. We will go to church for you so that you can still get your ecclesiastical endorsement. And all you got to do is pay us a nice little sum, which, by the way, one of the requirements is going to be you have to pay tithing on it.
Yeah. And then just recruit five friends to do the same thing. Then they can recruit five friends. And yeah, we'll all get stinking rich together by not going to church.
Traditional Mormon style. If we're going to Mormon, we're going to Mormon hard. This was my favorite one, okay? The brethren know what's right. Okay, all right, conversation's over. We're good, guys.
If there's a conversation stopper, that's it.
Yeah, so, all right, so Brian, the question of the week, and I think that I like this idea because there's some good meat to chew on here. What are your thoughts on the consolidated general conference schedule? So again, the Saturday night of general conference, it's either going to be priesthood session in April or the women's broadcast in October. So what are your thoughts? Do you think it's a positive move? Do you prefer it the old way? Would you like to see something else happen? I don't know. You know what, Brian? One of the interesting things I found when I was researching this, apparently there used to be another session of general conference. The general welfare meeting used to be held, what, at like 7 in the morning, the Saturday of general conference? Is that right?
I don't know, Brian.
I want to say I read that somewhere so someone can confirm that, since we don't have a problem calling you out about messing up on William McClellan.
It's better for me not to stick my foot in my mouth and say, oh, yeah, definitely. I remember that meeting. I used to attend it with my grandpa. No,
I was trying to bait you with that one, and obviously I failed. So Email us your thoughts, mail at mormonnewsreport.com, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or find us on Facebook and send us a Facebook message. And we'll be right back with Brittany Chapman Nash.
Have you ever been listening to an interview and get frustrated because just as they're getting to the good stuff, they end it? Are you the type of person who wants to be on the cutting edge of breaking Mormon news? Did your doctor recommend you increase your snark quotient every day as part of a well-balanced Mormon diet? Do you feel a moral imperative to support independent Mormon journalism and the Mormon News Report podcast? Then consider becoming a Patreon member to the Mormon News Report podcast. For just $1 or more per month, you can get access to our entire back catalog of Mormon News Report podcasts. Want to know what we thought of the 2017 October General Conference? It's in there. Want to know about that one Brant rant that had you scratching your head wondering, where is he going with this? It's in there too. As a Patreon subscriber to the Mormon News Report podcast, you also get a special podcast link to the Mormon News Report extended sessions where we roll up our sleeves and get intimate with our interview guests. And we always leave a choice insider nugget for your support. Your generous contribution helps us to produce the best in Mormon news with just a sprinkling of snark. So consider becoming a Mormon News Report Patreon subscriber today. Just go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com, and search for Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber today.
Welcome on to the show, Brittany Chapman Nash. Brittany, how are you? Thank you so much for coming on.
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
So, Brittany, I didn't know much about you before I read the book that we're going to be talking about. So could you just tell me a little bit, do you work for the Church History Department? Do I have that correct?
Yes, I do. I work at the Church History Library, and I specialize in women's history, although I do a variety of things in the department.
And how long have you been with the Church History Library?
I have been there almost 10 years now.
Wow.
And I fast.
So you've seen a very interesting evolution of everything that's been going on with Mormon history and including Mormon women's history in the last 10 years. You've kind of been living all that as we've been going through this evolution and seeing all the information that's coming out, right?
Yes, exactly. I started when we were in the church office building before the new Church History Library was built. And it is a different world, and it's exciting and amazing on the changes, particularly in women's history, that have taken place. So it's awesome. It's a great time to be in church history.
So I actually wanted to get into that a little bit before we get into the book, because to me, that is one of the more fascinating things that's happening. We've seen, for example, and I'm thinking specifically of what's been coming out from the Church History Library and the Church History Department, but we saw the first 50 years of the Relief Society. We saw Women at the Pulpit. It's a really good time for women's studies, and it seems like Mormon women's studies and Mormon women's history goes through these waves. Like, if I were to, you know, armchair quarterback a little bit, you're the expert, but like from what I see, it's the late 1800s, and so you've got the early saints' histories, those who lived, for example, the Joseph Smith days. They're getting older and they're trying to record them down. You've got the 1970s was another big time, and now the 2010s. So my question for you is this. Why do you think it goes through these waves? What's happening and specifically now that's making it such a hot topic or an issue that people want to talk about and publish about?
That's a great question. I think in the late 19th century, when there's the first wave of, I guess, what people might call Mormon feminism, there was a need that women felt. And it was kind of went in tandem with culture and women in general, national trends. In the 70s, again, I think there was a cultural shift and Mormon women came on board seeing new things, seeing need for change. And I think for whatever reason in the 2010s, it was time. It was like a zeitgeist. Things just came together. There was a renewed interest in Mormon women's history. There was institutional support for that history to explore that and continue that. So I think a need was definitely seen, and it was time to really take that need seriously and get down to the root of what is Mormon women's history. They're ready like with the Joseph Smith papers, there's a whole new emphasis on producing primary history using primary sources, kind of an unafraid look at Mormon history. And I think women's history is part of that.
Well, and I would also say one of the interesting things about this time period is that you still have some of those pioneer, I use pioneer in a very loose term, but it's not really loose, but those women during the 70s who are pioneering that, right, that second wave of women's history and women's studies, they're still alive. And so you are able to rely on their experience in the 2010s as we're going through this other wave. And it's really interesting to see how do I describe it? You've got the old guard that is kind of there helping to guide this new generation and to teach them the lessons that they've learned. And I don't know if that happened previously with like you said, the late 19th century.
Yeah, not that I've seen in the same way. In the 19th century, the interest sort of shifted in the 1920s. But definitely today there's a great, culture of mentoring and a great interest for the women who were involved in that second wave of Mormon feminism and sort of passing on their knowledge, passing on their enthusiasm for change. And, and today we're just soaking it up.
So let's talk a little bit about your series, and we're going to talk specifically about volume 4, but this is, like I said, the fourth volume in the series. So volume 1 in the Women of Faith in the Latter-day series covered 1775 to 1820. Volume 2 was 1821 to 1845. Volume 3, 1846 to 1870. And now, like I had said in the beginning of the show, we're on 1871 to 1900, which is, in my mind, and I don't want to speak for Brian, but in Brian's mind, one of the best times in Mormon history. Like, there's so much fun stuff that's going on there. So the question I have for you is, what different themes did you find researching each of these different times? And specifically in this volume 4, what's one of the biggest themes that you found that came out of volume 4, which is 1871 to 1900?
Right. One thing that I've loved noticing is the generational shifts. And really, Mormon history changed with each generation. The circumstances that they found themselves in were different. And as far as themes go, a lot of the themes depended on where physically the Latter-day Saints were at the time, the type of outside influences. So in Missouri, Kirtland, Nauvoo eras, they had a very different experience than the women who were born in Utah or came to Utah from different parts of the world. And when we've divided them up by years, that's by birth year, just in case listeners don't understand. It really is one generation sort of built on another with about 25-year gaps there between each volume when women were born.
Can I just jump in real quick and just ask what the decision-making process was behind doing this by birth year, as opposed to when they're most actively involved or whatever?
Yeah, we wanted a way for us to organize how we would decide what stories to tell. And we, again, wanted to feature the generations of Mormon women and how we stand on their shoulders. And so that's been an effective tool, I think, for us to look, a lens to look at Mormon women's history.
So, yeah, I agree. I think it's a really nice way to organize the series, and it makes for, each volume has a pretty, distinct tone to it, because you're going through different periods of social history at the same time, internationally and nationally. So, and we can talk a little bit more about that as we go.
Well, and I was going to say, to go along with what you were saying, Brian, I think what it also does is, while you're only focusing on that time period as far as births, it also expands it out a lot. And so it was really interesting to read further along into more than I thought. Speaking of one of the things that came up was war, because a lot of these time periods cover World War I, some cover World War II, some cover the Mexican Revolution that was going on. And so war seems to be a really big part of these women's lives. The question I have for you is, how did this affect them? And specifically, how did major events like World War I, which is a fascinating history to read into, just aside from these women's histories, but just everything that was going on, How did that affect these women's view of the gospel? Because that is a horrifically just barbaric time period to live in.
Yes. Well, I love Volume 4 because it does creep out of that pioneer era finally, and we get into some real stories that haven't been told in the mainstream as much as the pioneer settlement stories have. So we get a really different glimpse into how women were interpreting Mormonism, how they were applying it to their lives because their circumstances were different. And one thing I've really enjoyed working on is the women who lived in Europe during World War One, during World War Two, and getting their take on it, on the gospel, how they were introduced to it, how they used it to help deal with their life circumstances. They dealt with death in just horrific ways. And one of the women in the Volume 4 example, she lost two sons within a matter of weeks who were fighting on the Russian front, and then on a different area of the war they were, and she was in Germany, so she's German. And then she bears her testimony about how the gospel got her through that very difficult time. So you see themes of faith helping people get through difficult times. And you see that from Volume 1, and death in particular, and making sense of why these horrible things are happening and choosing to cling to faith instead of anger or, hatred.
I really liked that part of it. And you had mentioned something a little bit earlier about how we're finally out of the pioneer era.
Yeah.
And not that there's anything wrong with that, but it seems like all the focus has continually been on the pioneer era, right, where this is something that is very real that's going on. And I would say it's almost more real to me to read what they were going through than it is to read about the pioneer stuff, which, not that I want to, I hope this doesn't come across the wrong way, but we tread that road so many times. Everyone's well aware of all that stuff, but this is new stuff, and this is a new way of viewing it. And that was what stood out to me was, I don't know, I guess living in 2017, we don't comprehend, for example, how the cloud that World War One was over everybody, but especially for all the women that you covered in Europe, in Germany, in Switzerland, in the Netherlands, like all these women, it's like, I couldn't imagine living with that. And it's amazing how that all worked back into their own view of the gospel.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it is within arm's reach. I mean, many of us knew people, maybe our grandparents were involved in World War Two, or our parents, you know, it's something we can relate to directly through someone maybe we knew. So it's not an unfamiliar topic, and many things in lifestyles, technology, they were developing in ways that we recognize today, and lifestyle. So even though things have changed, it is something we can identify or relate to still. And it was really interesting.
So one of the things that
One
of the things that I wanted to just go along with that was persistent themes that I saw through each of these stories. And sometimes you don't see this from a male writer's perspective as much, but personal trials. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that men don't have personal trials. It's just that it seems to me they don't candidly write about them as much. Right? They sort of set themselves up in what they write as I don't know, not admitting to any sort of personal trials that they may have experienced sometimes. And sometimes you have to go to sources outside of it to see what was really going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. So I see that a lot of women are very candid about the personal trials that they faced and experienced. Some of it brought about by war. A lot of it brought about by sickness. Mm-hmm. We had the influenza epidemic of 1918. We had smallpox.
Right. Great Depression.
I saw a steadfastness of faith through all of this. And the one thing that really stood out to me, and this is going to seem so cliche, but I'm telling you, from a sincere vantage point, this was actually a bit of a surprise to me, is how much focus and importance there was on the concept of eternal family.
Yes.
As you know, as being really kind of the, as being kind of the great hope that gets them through all these trials.
Yes, and that was not done intentionally on our part. That's just what the women chose to write about. And we emphasized using the primary sources that women wrote so that they could tell their own stories in their own words.
Right.
And so I think that aspect of the gospel, especially during this time, was a real strength to them.
Yeah, and I say that because I think that sometimes we get this perception that we are increasing our focus on eternal family, and that this is like something that's been within the past 50 years, this kind of increased focus and emphasis on putting the eternal family at the center of our faith experience. But what this shows me is that this was just as important to them. And of course, you know, you can read Pioneer Diaries as they were walking across the plains. And for a lot of the women there, the reason that they were driven to continue going forward was because they felt that they could be sealed together with their family in the temple temple
when
they get there. So this is a really, I mean, for me, again, it's like one of those things that you listen to, you're like, oh, yeah, we've been talking about eternal family forever. But no, really, we have been talking about eternal family forever.
It was hugely appealing. And I was surprised as I learned about the women's stories, how many of them found the gospel, were drawn to the gospel because they had lost children or other family members. And the plan of salvation was a real comfort to them that just made sense and rang true to them.
So we've got about 5 minutes left. I'd love to highlight just a couple of stories real quick if we could.
Sure.
So what there was a lot that really stood out to me. Like we could talk about, well, I'll talk about my favorite, Brian, and you could talk about your favorite. But the one that I wanted to bring up was Camilla Irene Kimball, who is the wife of Spencer W. Kimball. I had always heard that there were a lot of people who always had a lot of fondness for Camilla. And I've read some of her writing. She was a great writer.
Yeah.
But what I wasn't prepared for was the rawness and the honesty that came from Camilla with so many things. I want to read you just one brief thing that she wrote. So Spencer was already called to the Quorum of the Twelve. He was away on church assignments a lot, and Camilla missed him. And Camilla was concerned about a lot of different things. For example, one of the things being that she, I don't know, is missing out, or let me just read it. She said, "Sometimes I almost feel in the press of your many responsibilities that I don't matter very much anymore. Anyone who thinks being the wife of one of the general authorities is a bed of roses should try it once, shouldn't they? Theoretically, I realize and appreciate all the blessings and advantages, but sometimes I selfishly feel it would be nice not to have to share my husband with a million others. I wouldn't have you be one whit less valiant in the pursuit of your duty, but it is comforting to be reassured once in a while that you realized I am standing by." And I read this to my wife, and my wife had this look on her face. It was a look of heartbreak. And then she told me afterwards, she's like, "I know what that feels like. Like, I feel that all the time. And it's mostly because I work with the youth. So it feels like I'm always gone doing something with them." But that was something that resonated with her. What was it like going through and reading some of those raw emotions from someone like Camilla? And how do you think Mormon women are going to experience that?
Yes, Camilla is one of my favorite women. That she just, exactly, that her honesty and her rawness just endeared me to her as well. And I loved, I mean, it's easy to stand in awe of these women and the wives of general authorities and think that they don't struggle with their husband's callings or don't struggle with their testimonies but one thing I love about Camilla is that she wrote about difficult things and she didn't try to come across as perfect. And I just loved that about her.
One of the things I loved about Camilla's story was how she kind of blew off Kimball at the beginning when he was trying to court her, right? He invited her to a dance. Good. Go ahead and tell us the story.
Okay. So she met Spencer at a bus stop and she liked him right away. And she was invited to go to a dance with another date. And they had kind of, her and Spencer kind of arranged things like, oh, Spencer would stop by at some point. And it just so happened that he stopped by as she was getting ready to go out with this other guy. And how she writes about it is just hilarious. So she's there with curlers in her hair and in a kimono getting ready for this dance. And she just invites Spencer to come along with them. So if you can imagine, all of a sudden there's this third wheel on your date. And she knew, in her words, she had played a shabby trick, and her date drove like the devil was behind him.
Right.
And didn't dance with her once at this dance they went to. But she had a great time with Spencer, and they had a whirlwind courtship and married a few months later.
So the one that I want to bring up, and then we'll have to finish the conversation a little bit later, if you don't mind sticking around a little bit longer.
Not at all.
Right. So you have, you know, there are in some of these, you've got kind of a more of a documentary history style where there's lengthy quotes directly from their own journal or diary. Some of these are more of a narrative form. There is one in particular, Anne Marie Boren Bigelow, that was written in 663 stanzas of rhyme. Not that all 663 are included in this volume. That would have taken up most of the volume, but excerpts from the stanzas. And I thought that was a really interesting one. And she had a really heartbreaking story talking about personal trials. Four of her siblings died in the space of 5 days. And man, she really had some words about the struggles of going through that. And I don't want to give away any spoilers too much to people who want to read the book. But let me tell you, when you get to that, bring a box of tissues.
Yes, it's. We wanted to include her story not only because it was so moving in her having her children die in such quick succession due to illness, but also to help people realize, hey, there are other ways to write your story than just a traditional biography. If poetry comes naturally to you, you can use poetry to record your own life story.
So, Brittany, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Do you have Brian asked you earlier, but do you have a few minutes to stick around after the show for a couple more questions?
You bet. Yeah.
Awesome. You can find Women of Faith in the Latter Days, Volume 4, edited by Brittany Chapman Nash and Richard E. Turley at Deseret Book, both in the retail stores and online. You can find it on Amazon.com or wherever you buy LDS books. And we'll be back after this.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about perspectives on Mormon theology, apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by todayinmormonhistory.com. 40 years ago this week, on October 26, 1977, some students in Brigham Young University's Washington, D.C. seminar were recruited to spy on professors there. One of the student reports of faculty surveillance intended for Ezra Taft Benson's office instead ended up on the desk of Mark E. Peterson. After being informed of this spy ring by Apostle Peterson, BYU's president Dallin H. Oaks angrily referred to that Birch Mafia that surrounds Ezra Taft Benson.
And here I thought it was just the communists who spied in D.C., Brant.
Listen, Brian, the eyes and ears are everywhere. Remember, loose lips sink ships. And that's a tongue twister for those of you. And that is our show, everybody. We'd like to thank Brittany Chapman Nash for joining us. Scott Holmes provided the music. Brian Whitney edited and produced today's show.
And, you know, we really appreciate your likes and your shares and reviews. We see it. We try to read them online. It moves us, guys. It moves us. Keep them coming.
Listen, I was going to say something along the lines of, I've got low self-esteem, so it makes me feel good. So make me feel good, everybody. But that'll probably be taken out of context. Remember, if you want to reach out to us directly, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. We will be back. And when will we be back, Brian? We're going to be back next week, right?
Yeah, we're going to try to, heaven help us. We'll be back next week.
Today is not a good day for me talking, but we will be back next week with more news, commentary, and interviews with a sprinkling of snark. Until then, we will talk to you again after a while.